Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to already the fourth episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. And we are very happy to welcome Daan Vriends, CEO of Cevetra. I know Daan for more than 20 years because we started together in Cargill as commodity traders as trainees. I started in Amsterdam and Daan started in Rotterdam. And the first time we met was in either of those towns, but it was to celebrate a first trade from another trainee, most likely. And we had a fantastic tradition that as a trainee, when you did your first trade, you needed to invite the whole trading floor to celebrate the trade. And the tradition was also that the whole Amsterdam team would visit Rotterdam and vice versa.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Daan made a fantastic career in Cargill and in Cevetra, and is now the CEO of a large trading franchise. And therefore, we're very happy to welcome him here today.
Yeah, welcome, Daan. I really look forward to it. We, of course, have all these questions, and all the listeners are curious about where you came from, what have you done, and great anecdotes, stories, anything you have, maybe still from back in the days. So welcome.
Yeah, thanks for being here and appreciate the invitation. I'm looking forward to the podcast of today.
Yeah, why don't you start with a brief introduction of yourself and we'll take it from there.
Pleasure. I always say I'm a Brabantse Rotterdammer. So for the ones who are not from Holland, I'm born and raised in the south of Holland. And I studied in Rotterdam, worked in Rotterdam. And after 8 years abroad, I moved back to Rotterdam. So half Brabant, half Rotterdam. Why do I say that? Because I think the two different cultures. Brabant is a bit more softer, Burgundic. Rotterdam are the workers and quite direct. And also my character is a mixture of that. Mm. So after studying, I started to work for Cargill, as Martijn referred to, in Rotterdam, which was not the place I was thinking of when you think about a nice multinational. This was the bottleneck, and then really deep in the bottleneck, where we were refining tropical oils, but also fish oil. So yeah. It was quite a smelly place. Yeah. Martijn might remember when you visited us. But fantastic. I mean, palm oil was an upcoming product. And it was growing very fast. And yeah, to start there, it was a very, very good place. Mm. After 4 years, I moved to Singapore, also trading tropical oils. And then came one of the crossroads. Do I continue to trade, pure trade, or go broader? So then I've decided to go broader. I went to Isegem, where Cargill had a refinery and a bottling plant, but more general manager-like roles. I did that after moving back to Schiedam, where the Cargill office was, the oils office. I did that 4 years, so in total worked 16 years for Cargill. And then I turned 40, so I always say jokingly at home, either a new wife or a new job. So I've chosen the cheaper one. So I moved to Cevetra, and after 9 months I turned CEO, and that's more than 10 years ago. So that's where I am
impressive
today.
Impressive career, Daan.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really impressive. I think that a lot of traders have that, to go from either you keep on trading or you go indeed broader, right? And then could be management roles or maybe different commodities. Can you take us through that moment that you had to choose? You know, what are the things, the pros and the cons at that time for you?
Yeah, I think I can better explain it now than at the time. So I think if you look at my profile as a person, I'm always in the orientation phase, they call that. So I like new things. And after 8 years of trading, I could do another product, but I thought, yeah, do I do this my whole life? That's, for me, that was too narrow. And I knew, if I'm not going to change now, then it will become more and more difficult. One, it's a nice environment, but also the money is good. You get branded. Mm-hmm. If you're a trading specialist, you're a trading specialist. But that coincided with both my parents were ill when I lived in Singapore. So I wanted to move closer home. Yeah. And then, my first boss, Jos Delors, immediately picked up on that and created that role in Belgium. Yeah. So it's a bit of a combination in what do I want. Yeah. If you now look back, I think that's I cannot do with and not without trading. Mm-hmm. I always explain. So with trading, pure trading, is too narrow. But I also had a couple of years that I did only sales. And then you miss the spark of trading. Mm-hmm. So after a while, I knew, okay, I want a boat. Mm-hmm. And yeah, then when Safitwa came by, which leading commodity trading company in the city where I lived, it was kind of a no-brainer. Yeah.
What was we had the discussion, actually, mm-hmm. I think, in the previous podcast as well. You see often that the best traders in the team become also then a manager, right? Mm-hmm. And now you were a trader, then become manager of a big company. How do you look at that? You know, is that the true? Is it the lucky shots? Is it how do you look at that?
I don't think per se the best trader is the best manager, but you need to have a certain level of credibility. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a minimum requirement of trading skills and trading capability, because otherwise the traders don't take you mm-hmm. serious. Yeah. But I don't think you have to be the best trader per se. Don't know how you see that, Martijn, but I actually don't. Probably the best traders are not always the best managers.
No, that's true. Leaders. But the thing is, if I look at myself, right, and I've stayed more than 25 years on the trading desk, and on the diehard trading trench, and what I enjoyed about it was that that's not a corporate environment. So as a trader, you know, you can speak your mind. You have no time. The market doesn't wait for you. And so there is little time for sensitivities on a trading desk. Now, outside of a trading desk in a large corporation, it's a different way of working together, a different way of being effective. Now, and that is one of the things that interests me, because, you know, we got along well in Cargill because you are very direct, very candid. But once you move into the higher echelons, and especially once you move out of the trading environment and you became first COO and later CEO of Safetra, it requires a different way of getting things done, with more sensitivities, making alignments, being more careful. Mm-hmm. How did you manage to do that?
Yeah,
because that maybe is slightly against your nature.
My nature, yeah. No, I think I call it different. So freedom for me is very important. Mm-hmm. So that was in trading the case, but also in running Safetra. So I had the luxury to work in a company now with a shareholder, Baywa, who leaves us really alone. Mm-hmm. So there's no day-to-day involvement at all. We have a quarterly supervisory board meeting. That's kind of it. Yeah, and every month I call in for the financial numbers. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of freedom. And that's key for me, and that's also how we have positioned Safetra. If you look at Safetra, it's 21 entities who are really decentral. Mm-hmm. So I try to copy the freedom you have as a trader. I try to copy that also within Safetra and the individual entities. Mm-hmm. Just before the podcast, we discussed our dairy team. Mm-hmm. You assumed it was in Rotterdam.
Yeah.
No, it's in Den Bosch. Mm. Why? We are decentral, and I take that quite far. Mm. So I believe a decentral empowered organization fits a trading company best. And then you also have to accept the consequences of being decentral. Mm-hmm. So you're not central then. Eh? So you might have missed some cost advantages or some synergies on innovation. But you can't have it both. You're mm-hmm. either decentral or you're central. And what you should not do is end up in the middle. Mm. I'm not here to talk about other companies, but... Mm-hmm. There are, I think, some companies fall into that trap. Mm-hmm. And they come in it, I call it vacuum, in the middle. Yeah, that's not good. And I believe trading companies should be decentral. People need to be able to decide on the table, mm-hmm. quick, agile, etc.
And what is then the advantage? Because you cannot be agile if you're not decentralized, or you cannot make quick decisions if you're decentralized. What's then? Why do you then need to be decentralized to do that?
I think a trader needs to have the freedom to decide without always having the feeling that someone looks over their shoulder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then they become defensive, and defensive and trading don't go together. You need to be offensive. You need to be willing to lose as well, to fail. Mm-hmm. And with that, you need that freedom of movement. If you always have to explain why you do something, you lose that freedom. Now, that doesn't mean you can do stupid. You need to be wise. But mm-hmm. but freedom is very important, mm-hmm. In my opinion. Yeah. So I don't only copy that to our traders, but to the whole organization.
So if they want to work,
I like freedom,
else.
So yeah. I also give freedom to the entities.
Yeah, so if they want to work in a different location, etc., that's all fine.
It's and we have 6 offices in the Netherlands. Yeah. And yeah, for the listeners abroad, the Netherlands is not that big. But yeah, if we acquire a company or a team, I think it's more important that they feel at home where they are than that we have the advantage of one office. So I take that quite far, that decentral thinking. Yeah. Because I'm a strong believer.
Yeah.
It fits us. And it fits me, that helps.
But as a trader, you think about your trading strategy. So you're part of a franchise, and a trading franchise, maybe a processor, determines the markets that you trade. You try to do the best that you can in that market, mm-hmm. but you don't really determine it. It's different when you become the CEO of the whole franchise. Then you really need to determine if you're not simply a caretaker, and that was not what you were hired for.
No.
You were hired to make a strategic direction, to make sure that Savetra remains relevant in the years ahead and keeps its edge. How did you do that?
Yeah. I actually do that as a trader. Mm. And that's something which also surprised me as well. But as a trader, you have assumptions on the market. You put that, I think the market is going that mm-hmm. direction. And then you start testing your own assumptions. Yeah. That's kind of what you're continuously doing. Yeah. Yeah? One thing you know for sure, your initial assumptions will not be right. Yeah? But then it starts. Then the game starts. You start testing. You start testing, are my assumptions right? What am I? If you look at the market, what are we doing?
Yeah.
For me, a strategy is completely the same. You put the dot on the horizon. Mm. I think we go in that direction. And then you start adjusting. Trade is more short term, strategy a bit longer term. Yeah. But in theory, it's the same mentality. Yeah. I always say you start with the plan and then with the numbers, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I don't spend a lot of time on budgets, financial budget. One thing I know for sure, they will be wrong. So why spend so much time on it? So I rather spend time on discussing, are we doing the right things? Mm-hmm. And if we do the right things, the chance that we do well is bigger than if we don't. So spend your time on that. And the numbers are derived from your actions and not the other way around. So I continuously, my assumption was this. It's not happening. Why not? And then you adjust your strategic approach.
Yeah. I saw this week some clips flying by on LinkedIn about Jeff Bezos. Mm-hmm. And he said 2 things I want to discuss with you. He said one of the things, customer obsession. So he said, don't worry about competition, but focus on the customer only. It sounds obvious, but a lot of people are very busy with looking at what the competition is doing. That's one thing I'd like mm-hmm. to know. And one super interesting thing as well, I find that he said that he is usually the latest one in a meeting to say something mm-hmm. because he wants young people to be comfortable to come up with their plan and not being biased or impressed by the head of trading. And I recall, you recall as well, when sometimes Paul Hickman, mm-hmm. who's head of trading of Golden Agri Resources, when he was in the meeting, when we had a huge global oil meeting in Cargill, when Hickman said something, wow, that was impressive for the young people.
Yep.
Now, so how do you deal with that when you are in a meeting, a trading meeting, where then the CEO, not always I assume, but sometimes the CEO is in?
How do you deal with it?
Yeah. How do you make sure that there is an environment where everyone can speak their mind? So those 2 things. So the customer centricity and the...
Yeah, let's start with the second one because that's not my strength. So actually the best way for me of dealing with it is to not be in the meeting.
Okay.
I'm extremely extrovert and I can try. So one of my old HR leads said, Dan, every time you open your mouth, at least half of the time, put a candy in it instead of say something. So that's not my strength. Mm. So in meetings, I'm in or I'm out. Mm. And I've accepted that.
Yeah.
So I'm not proud of it, but it's what it is.
To add on that, actually, the same guy that you just mentioned, Jeff, he also said, always the most senior people should talk last. because the most young people, they always get influenced by the older one. Even if you don't want to, right? So if you start talking, they will be influenced in what they say. And maybe they're like, oh, maybe I'm scared, I'd not say anything. Or their opinion gets changed and they don't say out blunt what they would like to say. Mm-hmm.
I do know the story, but what I do encourage a lot is stretch talents. So this empowered, we do with entities. I also expect our entities to do that to their traders. Give them the challenge, give them the stretch. Have a culture of failure, and everyone says yes, 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 culture of failure. But when traders make money, I'm more critical than when traders lose money. Mm. You don't have to tell a trader who's losing money that he's losing money. He or she knows. Mm-hmm. So I'm supportive when they lose money and I'm a bit more critical when they make money. And, so, and that's the way I like to stretch them, give them freedom. Freedom is a lot of, I use it a lot. Mm-hmm. It's about freedom. But in the meeting itself, it's in my development plan now for 12 years called active listening, I believe. Co-active coaching. I also had a course on that. It's not my steel. I'm sorry.
That brought you a lot of other things.
Maybe on the customer. I think there was a video and it's called Founder's Mentality. I don't know if you have seen it. No. Alexander can refer to that. But when you start a company, the founder has the mentality and often it's around the customer. Mm. It's all around the customer.
100%, yeah.
And then you start growing. Mm-hmm. Then you hire a CEO who can do that better than you because you're the entrepreneur. You hire someone of HR. You hire... Mm-hmm. And actually, this video says you are kind of derailed from your founder's mentality, which is around the customer. Mm-hmm. Now, that's why I think to serve the customer, a decentralized, empowered organization as Savitra has does fit. I have to explain that we don't have many cross-entity, cross-region customers. Mm-hmm. I mean, the compound feed market is still very fragmented. The food ingredient market, you have a lot of customers. So... Yes, we have some key account management, but the vast majority of the customer base is regional. Mm-hmm. That helps, correct, in such a setup. So we believe that you want to have people who feel ownership of the customer, and you should spend 80% of your time with external things. Can you supply a customer and not with internal? Mm-hmm. And that's where it often, to my opinion, goes wrong. You kind of derailed by the internal... Well-meant discussions. Don't get me wrong, because everyone means well, but you kind of fall into that trap if you grow bigger to become corporate.
Yeah,
but I think it's good that you are actually and that your character is what you say is looking external, right? You're extrovert, right? So that's also often always looking outside, and that's the client in this case, right? So I think there where you have somebody that's also very much externally focused and extrovert, etc. They like clients. They like the commercial side often, not always, but often. I think that really helps with what you're trying to achieve. What you're achieving is that you keep the customers so central in everything you do.
Yeah.
Maybe your character.
Yeah. I have to think about it. If it's the character or the... Not sure. You can also be extrovert, but I like to meet people. I think you refer to that. That helps. And the only thing is, and that's why I'm reflecting on it, because I give so much freedom and we are decentralized empowered, my customer-facing time is too little because the MD of the entity does it. Or the So that's you see me thinking, I would love to see way more customers than I see today. But that might be a consequence of our setup.
I think for most traders that are listening now, it's music to their ears. Freedom, license to trade, freedom to operate is extremely important. But there are also critical moments where you need to be extremely decisive. It could be a crisis situation. And for example, like COVID, which was an unprecedented, extreme situation. Can you explain to us a bit how you dealt with it? Because then you're the CEO and it can be lonely. You have a management team.
Yep.
But you, like in society, I can imagine that there are a huge amount of different opinions and people, maybe different emotions, whatever, right? But could you explain how you felt? And that's also a difference from being a trader at the time versus responsibility for the whole operation and safety of people. And that's, I assume, but I'm interested to hear from you, that that was really a moment where you felt like, oh, yeah, now it's up to me and I need to make some important decisions. And now we also talked about the customer, right?
No.
When supply chains were impacted, how do you... You don't want to apply force majeure and all these type of things. So share with us a bit that situation.
Yeah, so if, I mean, we look back now, it's a couple of years ago, but the first thoughts are way more about the safety of the people and the health than the business. Mm. Somehow the business, rather quickly, we realize, ooh, quite some turmoil here. We don't have assets. I think I have to explain Cefetra Group. Yeah. It's very light in assets. We have some we own some silos or some modification plans, but our blue collar is rather limited. Mm-hmm. That helped in Corona because it's, I think to keep a plant running was a huge challenge.
Yeah.
For us, I was impressed how quickly we moved to hybrid working or to home office, and then also here we are decentral, so. One entity said 100% from home. Mm-hmm. Another entity said, oh, I want them more in the office. Mm-hmm. So also there, I take this decentral empowered quite strong. They are best to judge what's needed for their company to be able to continue to run. I had one prerequisite, the health and the safety of the people. So that's why I put the line. So if you work, then 1.5 distance, this, that, et cetera. No external visitors, cleaning. We all went through it. But for the rest, the entities could decide on their own. Yeah, quite quickly we saw, the supply chain constraints could also provide us some opportunities.
Yeah.
Which they did.
Yeah, which at the end of the day is then you realize, but that's our job, right?
Yeah.
We thrive in volatility and taking risk.
Yeah, huh? Absolutely. I think the better example for Cefetra is the Ukrainian situation.
Oh, yeah?
I think, we used to have an office in the Ukraine, which we happened to close just a year before the war.
Mm-hmm.
We usually had 1 million tons outstanding, roughly, which we purchased. So we purchased a lot of grains, which we bring to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
By chance, we only had 600,000 tons outstanding. And then in the run towards the war... No one really believed in the war, but then the risk reward comes.
Yeah.
I think the risk reward, we could buy a bit in Romania for a couple of euros more expensive.
Yeah.
A trader doesn't want to do that. Because what happens, because of the risk, Ukraine became cheaper and Romania becomes more expensive. Yeah.
Arbitrage
money. Oh, down, and no, the war is not going to happen and this and that. And there I really stepped in. I said, I want a maximum exposure of X.
Yeah.
I didn't believe in the war either. But actually, a colleague of ours calls risk. Risk is chance times impact.
Mm-hmm.
The impact would have been huge. And if we would have had 1 million tons outstanding, it could have be the end of Cefetra.
Yeah.
So then you have to de-risk.
Yes.
I think that's there you have to step in. And there as a CEO, you look at that different because you look at the whole.
Yes.
Then a trader who trades corn,
I
think, ooh, I can make an extra million here.
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
That is
there you have to step in, which is, and if I would be wrong, all the traders would be very angry with me. Eh? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The war would, you lost us million, you cost us millions.
Yeah, and, then it's your head.
Yeah, right, now I, Dan, he saw it well, but I didn't see it well. I just took the needed risk-reward decision.
Yeah.
And I think everyone would do the same. Yeah. In that position.
Yeah. Great decision.
You cannot bet the company. No. Correct.
That's
you can bet a risk position, a commodity position, but you cannot bet the company.
Well, look, that is a critical thing. And also for our listeners, super interesting that you say this, because if you look online, and some books, for example, as well, and some movies, it is about traders who want to bet the house, and somehow those traders, they always get hired again, because somehow people fancy the big risk takers. But I've experienced it in cocoa several times, that companies blew up, and that is called the cocoa graveyard. And I find it insane that people are so selfish that they actually risk not only the money, but in fact the exposure that they have to customers that they need to default to, and the employees, right? So you always need to have a situation where I think it's a perfect example of leadership, where you are in the spotlight,
yep,
and take the decision for the survival of the company. You know, I described it here in my trading style on a smaller scale, but when I was head of cocoa trading for many years, my style was the game is to survive, not to shine. Yeah. And that sounds a little bit defensive, but in cocoa that was necessary given the amount of companies that went bust. Nowadays, currently, as we speak, my discussion with my friends in the cocoa industry is who's going to fall over,
yep,
in current environment. So I'm quite curious.
I think it's also a balance of the team, right? So besides the CEO that needs to have that decision that you make, I think you look at risk on a weekly, monthly basis. How often do you look at something
basis,
like that?
I think.
Daily. Yeah. And then, you know, but if you look at teams where you want to have a defensive, offensive players, mm-hmm, right there, you maybe would like to have more kind of a balanced approach, yeah, of kind of types that you want in your team.
No, absolutely. You need that balance. But I think that what is underestimated, that even guys like Paul Tudor Jones, right? I met him a couple of times, very lucky to be able to interact with him. But he says defense first. Yep. And people always think that these guys think in offense. But they always think about, okay, how much can I lose, right?
Yeah, but yeah, I think we have both been raised in more risk reward than risk. I think, mm-hmm, I never say we're risk takers. Mm. I always say we're risk reward takers.
Yeah.
But that's a little bit the education we, yeah, both have, Martijn. So the, yeah, best traders I met always looked, what if I'm wrong?
Yeah.
And if then they say, oh, even if I'm wrong,
yeah,
my losses are so-so,
yeah,
then they went big.
Yeah.
Now, I've met also a lot of other traders, mm, who kind of only looked, what if, yeah, it goes right?
Yeah.
And yeah, they go for the home runs. I'm not a home run trader. I've never been a home run trader.
Yeah.
I've been a balanced trader.
Yeah.
That does also mean that there are in massive bull years, yeah, yeah, I earned less.
Yeah.
Yeah. But my downside was always protected.
Yeah.
And that's the style. Yeah. And I'm more comfortable with that style. I call, yeah, it the risk reward style instead of the risk on style.
But that's a sustainable, yeah, style. When we mentioned the leadership, and you mentioned already one name, what are the leaders that you admire? What are the key things that you have learned from them in your long career?
Yeah. Yeah, we mentioned Paul Hickman already here. That's was my boss in Singapore.
Yeah.
He is a remarkable trader.
Mm-hmm.
I think the ones I've worked close with. He cannot listen to the podcast, otherwise he starts shining even more. But he had it all. The risk reward, the timing, he could turn around at the right time. He,
mm-hmm,
as a trader, his timing was perfect. And also the way he could explain the market.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if someone can explain the market, yeah, really well to you, if this happens, and then, yeah,
connecting the dots.
He really grasped it. So
yeah.
I learned from him a lot on the trading side. Cool. Then my first boss and the one who hired me, Jos Delors, I really admired him on his strategy, his strategic thinking. He really looked forward longer term. Yeah. He has been growing two businesses from quite substantially. And yeah, as a person, I think he's one of the most friendly people we know. Yeah. You also you used to work for him.
Yes, absolutely.
But I would say strategy is Jos, trading Paul Hickman, and then I had Stan Ryan. That was one of my last bosses in Cargill. And the way he looked at talent development was something I really enjoyed. He really stretched talents. He said, when it's a talent, you need to stretch the person. Someone who does well in the job, but is in the way of talent development, someone else, you have to change. Sorry, but the talent first. He took that extremely far, but I took that on board. So the whole talent development and the way he looked at organizations, I learned from him. That's my old my own bosses, correct? My own experience.
Now we have a lot of young listeners.
Sorry, have to.
We have a lot of young listeners.
Yeah,
they want to know, you know, how do I break into the commodity industry? So they want to know, what is it that we look at? What is it that you look at? There's one thing. And do you get involved still in hiring graduates at times or juniors? What are the things you really find important?
Yeah, you have to have a certain level of conceptual thinking. Yeah. So in our process, we have a case. You have to make the case.
Yeah.
You cannot get hired by making the case well, but you can not be hired by not making the case well. So kind of that is, you need to have a minimum conceptual capability.
Yeah.
Then, I think it's the usual suspect type of things we look at. I always courage and conviction. So you need to have the courage to think your own way, to make your own plan, to go against others' opinions, all that. But you also have the conviction, and the conviction comes in, to tell yourself, oh, I'm wrong. And so I always say, courage, because with only courage, you probably go to this full risk-on type and you believe in your own story. Oh, you need to have the conviction, especially to yourself. Oh, I'm not right. Exit.
Yep.
With that comes, you need to be able to fail. And that's maybe sometimes underestimated. So a very good trader is, you know, the better Martijn, 6-7 out of 10 times right.
Yeah.
But when you're wrong, it's a very lonely place.
Yeah.
You cannot blame anyone. You try, but you cannot blame anyone. No. It's you. And you just failed. Yeah. And that's a very lonely place to be, which you need to be able to deal with. So in that process, if you are too much a perfectionist, usually you're not a trader, which is not you're probably better in another area. And I always like find that funny to say, but when someone made the case really well, then I sometimes test. Okay, then I tell the person, you didn't do the case really well, eh? Then you can test a lot. So there are some they're really upset. Can it be? I did really not a trader.
Yeah.
And then people say, oh, I did well. It's all well. It's all good. Okay. So that is where you can different test reactions. A little bit conviction. But the perfectionism and trading, it sounds a bit strange because you need to read a lot and say a lot, but you always make a decision based on partial information. So no perfectionism.
I find this critically important, and I'm happy that you say this.
Yeah.
I say it often as well to very smart people that I interview, and I see resumes that I'm thinking, look, I'm a nobody. Yeah?
Yeah.
I'm a hollow old school economics student. Yeah. If you see what nowadays they do, right? But I need to explain to them that the job of trading is not some kind of scientific perfection. You will always need to trust your judgment based on 60% of what you want to have and be decisive. You have a lot of nutty professors who can't deal with that because they seek perfection, which will never happen in trading, right?
I agree. I see it also with Vesper, where we supply information to traders, to buyers, to sellers, but we have part of it, but to make it 360 degrees, you don't have all the information to make your call if you're going to take a position long or short. You know, maybe you cannot call all your clients, you didn't speak to all your suppliers, you don't know how much is stock levels, is exactly how much is on the boat, so you have with your team, you can gather a lot of information, you can have the Vespers, the Bloomberg terminals, etc. But still, there is like this area where it's blind. You basically you have to make a call still with your team on some, not 100% information. If you feel comfortable with that as well, I think.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I think we are quite on the same page here.
That's
we agree.
Yeah.
Perfectionism is a good characteristic or capability, but maybe not for a commodity.
No, but on the other hand, and therefore you said it may sound strange, is that you do need people who need to do the nitty-gritty work, the S&D stuff, and who need to do the homework. And if and that's another thing where I sometimes surprised about when doing an interview, because when you do graduates or people who have worked for 1 year, you still need to look for signals that they are able to trade and that, like you said, that they need to be able to make an analysis. Yeah. So what I often ask them is, look, do you have some exposure to the market? It can be 5,000 euros or 1,000 euros. It can be a small equity exposure. It can be crypto.
Yep.
Yeah. And what I've noticed, and again, these rocket scientists, when I ask, okay, so how did you make your decision? And what kind of valuation metric? Or how do you look at risk? It's quite interesting to see how shallow often these answers are. I find that amazing.
Yeah.
While there are also people who actually really impress me with the depth of their analysis. That is what I like.
Oh.
Because that is the type of behavior that you can then expect on a trading desk as well. You need some sort of carpet trading sentiment traders, but what I really like to see in people that they have really done the homework.
Yeah, you need to have the drive to go for the last set, and that's why it might be misleading perfectionism. But I think if you link perfectionism and failing, so a perfectionist usually fails less than someone who's not a perfectionist. I always connect the two. So why not a perfectionist? Yeah, one, you cannot know everything.
Yeah.
But second, the failing element.
Yeah.
And especially the last one, a perfectionist usually is a perfectionist because he or she doesn't like, I think, those two dots are.
A nice thing that I think about now is that you said you were more supportive when a trader was losing money. And we all know indeed that on a trading floor, everyone knows, okay, that desk, they are not in good shape. And then you see someone from the higher echelon walking around that desk asking some questions. But the thing is, I had a situation once where I was in a shit trade for some time. And then my boss at the time, Philippe Huet, he said, Martijn, don't worry about it. It's not your money.
Yeah.
It's the family's money. And although, you know, I've always behaved like an owner, and you know, in Cargill, you do feel
like an owner,
the family. You do feel like, it is a family-owned business. And, You behave, the strength of Cargill is that most people behave like an owner.
Yep.
Now, but the fact that
most commodity traders do with their own book is their book, correct? Exactly. They own it.
You feel it.
But the thing is that he said that to me was a great relief at the time, because I didn't feel the stress on my shoulders anymore. That my boss said, "Look, Martijn,
it's okay.
Don't worry about it. It's okay." Oh. And that I think, you know, helped me greatly to be relaxed and
less stressed.
Less stressful.
You make better decisions maybe also when you're relaxed, right? Because let the boss in that case feel the pressure, right? Let him feel the pressure so that you as a younger guy can really learn and develop. Yeah. And you know, should you already at that stage when you're younger than how you were at that stage already feel that pressure, right? Maybe your manager should maybe feel it a bit more.
I think we all remember a bad trade's better than a good trade. So it tells you already what the impact is and how important it is that you are supported.
Did you have some bad or good trades that you can recall? Or the
some good
anecdotes?
Many.
Yeah.
The best anecdote we always share is I was in the bottleneck and the big boss was Jos Delors. And then we had Emiel van Dijk, who's now the head of Cocoa and Chocolate of Cargill, was the trading head. He went on holiday for 2 weeks. And then we had to promise that we didn't do anything big. So Andrew Perkins from the UK was just in our office a year or so. I was there for 1.5 years. So we did our supply and demand analysis. We only do this market is going down. So we sold Palmoline. PK at $6.35, just the day after Emil left for holiday. Mm. No phones yet in those days, so he came back. And of course, we discussed that with Jos, who was also bearish. I'm a bear trader, by the way. I'm more bear than a bull trader.
Mm.
So usually my mistakes are to the bear side. And Emil came back, and it was trading $7.25.
Wow.
So we were standing with the three of us, head down. Sorry, Emil, sorry. It was not my biggest loss, but the one we remember the best,
Just in, yeah, but that's, yeah, how, that's how you do,
especially,
right?
Especially above the circumstances.
And how was his reaction?
If you know Emil, Emil's always moderate in his reaction, so it's okay. It's fun. It's one of my best friends, so we are okay. Yeah, that was one that.
What did you do with it?
Up.
What did you do?
We
did you sweat it out?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
as a real bear trader, you hang in.
Yeah.
And it was way too early. Way too early.
You didn't close it the same evening.
No. We stayed in, and at the end it corrected. But when you're too early, it's also not good. It was not a good trade because we could have made 100 bucks more. Yeah. We would have stepped in later. But this is just a funny example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a good one.
Yeah, the one I enjoyed when I was young the most is a huge carry trade in coconut oil. So the coconut oil was trading back then at $190 FOB Philippines, which is it's now I think 1400 or something, but it was historic low. But the market was in a huge carry, so you have double shipment months in coconut oil, and those were $10 to $15 carry per month.
Mm-hmm.
So we bought all the stocks, we sold forward,
and
we shipped it from South Philippines to North Philippines, Batam, and I stored 150,000 tons, which was in those days a lot of coconut oil, in actually a mineral oil terminal, which we cleaned, but it was not tenable anymore, so you could not sell it. We took the risk, I can sell it for non-food usage.
Yeah.
Coconut oil is also big in the oleochemicals
industry. Of course,
But yeah, we shipped it there. I think the shipping was $20. So we already made $10 by putting it there.
Yeah.
Total carry cost was $1.50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
So I made $8.50.
Yeah.
Financing in those days was not a real item in Cargill. Plus, it was cheap. So by just sitting there, it was a couple million a month. What I like about it, you use your physical edge around the trade. So my example would always be a real physical trade where you use the supply chain expertise to make money. Because, that's, I think, a very nice expertise to be in.
Yeah, right.
Did you like the financial side of the physical trade as well?
I'm not sure if I really get
the hedging, right? So the hedging, futures, etc. To complement your fiscal side.
Okay, now I understand. Yes, of course. I mean, the future trading is quite sexy, but my heart is more. I like the physical products more because you get only one or two chances. So I believe I put young talents always on the physical trade first. Not on the futures. More reasons to that, but I think the physical, it really is this feeling, this fingerspitzing gevoel. You learn the best in the physical trade. Plus, usually there are smaller products, so you can put a young trader as a number one. That's your product.
Usually,
the future traded products, you are the number two or number three. Don't do that, because you know, as a number two or three, the number one is looking, is watching you.
Yeah.
So I always say your talents, put them not on the big products. Mm-hmm. No, put them first on the small products and let them feel how it is. Yeah. This is my position. It's me. So ASAP, own product.
Yeah.
That's a good
advice.
That's a good thing. And you learn the contract specifications as well.
Yeah.
You become aware of logistical constraints. I traded at some stage sunflower meal.
Yep.
Which came out of the factory, and there was hardly any storage, right? So at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, I needed to call Arcady.
Please
come with the coaster. And sunmeal was not that important, of course, but you get used
you to move it,
the critical things in physical commodity tradings.
Yeah, I agree.
And the contract, which is the basis of disputes, right, which you want to prevent, but when there is a dispute, you want to be able to know what are your obligations and your rights.
Yeah.
And you'll notice that less when you trade out of futures, of course. Yeah. Hey, one other thing which I find very interesting and curious how Savetra looks at that. So nowadays you see in the markets players like Citadel who trade basically any asset class, and they have They have access to capital. Citadel is one of the most, if not the at the moment, successful hedge funds in the world. They have access to computing power. They have access to all the best talent in the world, and they impact markets. Now, how does Savetra look at that? Do you notice the impact of those players who are not necessarily fundamental traders like yourself, mm-hmm. have an impact on the market? And for example, do you have a way to build a data science function, which, you know, maybe not like Citadel, but at least tries to get a better feel on the impact of those traders on your markets?
Yes, of course we have to. I think even if we would not like to speculate, we're now doing 60 million tons of physical goods. Just to hedge that or to run that supply chain, it's not all back-to-back. So just only for that, you need to have top market intelligence. Where do I put my hedge? How do I do my time spreads? Product for cash, product versus cap, the whole shimoni. Yeah. I was positively surprised when I joined Savetra, coming from a multinational with companies across the world and entities across the world, how good that market research team was. Young, but quite good. Good people, but also, I think, because they looked at the world more as one, where the bigger companies, they add up all the individual data, they might have been able to be a bit quicker in separating the real important things from trends from the less important trends. So, but yeah, it starts with good people. I had the luxury that we have quite some good people there. Then in 2016, we had quite a difficult year. And one of the positions was you used to hedge a premium long with a long and a premium short with a short.
Yeah.
Especially in markets where you have a delivery mechanism. Mm-hmm. So one thing, I mean, South American soya meal, you cannot tender on the US. So you should wonder what the correlation is. But still, everyone traded it like that.
Yeah.
And second, because of the involvement of these hedge funds or the funds, we noticed that the correlation became very unpredictable. We did an analysis, there's no correlation. Yeah. So a premium position is as risky as an outright flat or short. Yeah. I'm very blunt on that. People don't always see it like that, but I mean, history has shown it, I think, and the data proved that. Also, I think a misunderstanding is markets are not more volatile because of the involvement of hedge funds. Yeah, you have higher peaks and higher lows, but they're not more volatile. Yeah. That's sometimes something which is people mixing that up. But because of these higher peaks and higher lows, the price discovery, and now I come to the word that I use here a lot, the price discovery has become more difficult.
Yeah.
So when I started, I gave an example, when I was too early, you could usually sit it out when you were right.
Yeah.
If you're early today, with these huge spikes up and down, you're stopped out. Yeah. So the timing of a trader today is more difficult than 25 years ago. So that does mean we work more with options. We jump more on the trend than before the trend. It's a different way of trading than we used to do. And that's how we try to deal with it. Next to that, we have reached out. We have reached out to these kind of hedge funds, so we actually exchange ideas. Let's say it like that with them. By that, they get some information from us, and we start to understand their positioning better. And of course, we know the position of the hedge fund and the speculative money. But especially the personal contact is a step we took 2016 onwards, and we are kind of connected to almost all of them, the major ones. So that helps. Explain a little. It has been a big thing.
I think it's very good that you say it again, and I recognize it as well. You have runaway markets, liquidity voids. Sometimes indeed caused by options. You have gamma squeezes, and you have no correlation between the derivatives and the underlying anymore. And then you run a big Texas hedge.
Yeah, happened a lot.
Are there specific look that can happen? Can it happen in any commodity market, or do you need specific variables or specific factors in a market where you have, maybe it's a small supply side, big demand side, or where there's liquidity, there's no or less liquidity on the future market, or could any market be open to this?
Well, I think what Dan said is as I see it as well. You have more market extremes, so you can have a market that remains irrational longer than before. Also, because these excessive moves, they suck liquidity. People get scared. Yeah, and that is also what I've seen, for example, when in Cocoa in 2019, the living income differential was introduced. Exactly what Dan said, the correlation between the underlying and futures was broken due to an artificial impact from a government.
Yeah.
Liquidity tanked dramatically.
In the future market.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because people didn't want to participate anymore because they knew the cash convergence was broken. So what you say, price discovery, it didn't work anymore.
No.
And if it doesn't work anymore, people say, well, I'm not able to hedge my physical business on the forward. So there was no liquidity from hedges neither anymore. So markets became more like a spot market.
Yeah.
But this is something, and this is also one of the things that I would like to use in this podcast to explain it. Now, I told you, at this very moment here in Amsterdam, and there is a World Cocoa Foundation week, the cocoa market at the moment is up in flames. Now, it has to do with the historic crop scare, bad weather, but also years of, say, aging trees, aging farmers, and all these things. But an important thing in my mind is, and that is the elephant in the room, is lack of understanding of how the futures market works.
Functions or not functions in
or
this
not
case.
Functions. Yeah. And the importance of the futures market for price discovery. Mm. It's critical.
I agree.
Yeah, no, but you explained it perfectly. And it can be disrupted by interference by governments, but also by hedge funds who come in as a bull in the China shop.
But maybe that can happen faster in a cocoa market due to certain elements than maybe a grain market, right? I don't know, because maybe it has much higher liquidity. I'm not sure, but...
Yeah, but I mean, we trade soya, we trade wheat, we trade corn. Yeah. And I mean, every trading meeting is about the position of the spec funds.
Yeah.
And then you have the institutional spec and the short-term spec.
Yeah.
And you know when they turn around... When they have a big position, they can keep adding. But when they turn around, it can be explosive.
Yeah.
So you have to keep it in mind. And it goes so quick.
Yeah.
So it's not that it happens in a day and then bid. No, it's limit up.
Yeah.
Well, you're too late by default. So you need to find a way of managing that, which it's just a new element which you have to deal with. It also gives opportunities. It's not all bad. But the price discovery, the most important thing is you don't see it as a hedge per se. I mean, there are moments that it is a hedge. Usually, the longer out you go, longer term, the correlation is better than short term. Yes. But I rather work with options. I often say you can better hedge your outright long or short with an option protection than put all these future hedge. And where you put the hedge and which month?
Yeah.
And then you need to start rolling your hedge. And plus the whole day, the trade is busy with that.
Yeah.
And not with selling or buying or new business development. So you have it. It's part of a functional role to have this position. Invest in an option construction, but don't fool yourself in this continuous future hedges.
Hey, looking at the time, is there maybe one thing we still want to know, Dan?
A lot of the listeners, they will hear that you're very enthusiastic about the business. Yeah, and that's also, that all of us are enthusiastic.
Yeah. Love it.
And we like to wake up people who also not thinking about commodity trading, and we want to support those who are considering it. And what is your advice when people kind of dabbling, whether they should go to, for example, investment banking or commodity trading. And if you want to tell them why commodity trading, and then what should they do in order to land a job as a commodity trader in a tier one company?
Yeah, thanks for the question. First of all, yeah, I have a huge passion for the commodity world. I mean, I feel blessed that I started. It's not that I had a huge idea, I'm going to go to commodity trading and my whole life, I have to be honest about it. But from day one, it has been fitting as a glove. Now, what do I like so much around it? Maybe I start from myself and then I zoom in on the what others can do. It's honest. It's quick. So you know rather fast if you did well or not well.
Yeah.
So when you're a bit impatient and
quick results.
Quick results. Yeah. It's measurable.
Yeah.
It's a very tangible result.
Correct.
It's not subjective. It's very objective if you did well or not well.
Yeah.
So that's what I meant with honest. It's a very honest job. Quick results. So dynamic, global, geopolitical. Yes. But I think those two are quite specific. And maybe most important, the people.
Mm.
So the people in such an industry, people, you have to think about the world glass half full. Although, yes, risk reward, and I look at the downside, but you need to think in opportunities. So the people are opportunity driven.
Yeah.
So generally, that are nice people. You also trade with each other. So yes, there's a lot of competition, but competitors also need each other in the physical supply chains. And that gives a certain dynamic. I'm talking especially about the agri commodities because that's the one I know best. It's a dynamic that, it's a very nice industry to work in. The passion is clear. Then, if you're interested, of course, you should follow the elective of the Rotterdam Management School. I believe it's the RSM on the lead of Wouter Jacobs, who has a very nice elective on commodities and supply chains. It's the only one I know in Holland. I think in Switzerland
there is one in Geneva.
Then you can really study and reach out to people.
Yeah.
I think almost every commodity trader, if you reach out to such a person, wants to talk about it.
Yes. Yeah?
We love it. We are passionate.
Yeah.
I haven't mentioned it, but commodity trading is
24/7.
Mm-hmm. It's always in your head.
Yeah.
So you need to have a passion. Passion for it. Yeah. Nice holidays, but you see something on the news, you see shit. High water.
What was the position again?
High water, low water, my barges. Which is very nice, but it's 24/7. You need to be addicted.
Red Sea now, a little bit to it. It's so active. Yeah.
So that means passion, big. Yeah. But they love to explain about it. So just reach out.
Yeah.
Everyone is welcome to send me an email or LinkedIn. I always make time for people to invite them and show our business and see if it fits them.
Amazing. Okay, great.
Well, then we come to the end of our fourth podcast now. So, Daan, it was amazing having you here. I wrote something that I learned from you that I think we should also mention later on. But I think it was amazing to have you here. Amazing podcast. Loved your answers. Honest. And I love what you say, the mix of Brabant, a bit of Rotterdam. I think that helps you also with your business. I think it's true. So perhaps you do some carnivals and skiing, what the Dutch people do in the south part of the Netherlands at this time. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks for being here. And we will keep on following you.
It was a great pleasure being here.
Yeah. And I also want to thank you. And you know, I always say to people about you that you're very accessible, right? Such a respected guy with such an impressive career, but you're very accessible. Very nice guy, lots of insights, and both credible on the trading side and on the business leadership side. And I find that very interesting for our audience. So thanks for your insights.
Appreciate it. Thanks for that.